Hub
and Spoke Audio Collective.
We can have the future we want, but we have to work for it.
You're listening to Season 4 of Soonish. I'm Wade Rausch. If you're like me, you've spent the last couple of months of the pandemic sitting at home, wavering between despair and hope, between boredom and anger, between respect for the medical heroes on the front lines in our hospitals, sympathy for the victims and their families, and disbelief over the lack of a national strategy to slow the pandemic and get the economy back on track. For my part, I've also been thinking a lot about how the new coronavirus spread so far, so fast, and why we weren't better prepared for something like this. And since I make a podcast about the future and how we can bend it in certain directions, I've been puzzling over one question in particular. What can the art of futurism tell us about how this pandemic arrived and the world it's likely to come after? Of course, futurists go by a few different names. Sometimes they prefer to be called scenario planners or foresight thinkers. But their basic job is to help the rest of us understand the big trends that'll shape the future, so that we can be smarter about picking the future we want and navigating that future once it gets here. So here's what I wanted to ask a futurist. Is a cataclysm like the coronavirus pandemic of 2020 the kind of event that you can see coming? If you can, then why didn't we do more to get ready? Why has our actual response to the coronavirus pandemic been so clumsy and so uncoordinated, at least here in the US? And above all, how should an experience like the spread of COVID-19 shape the way we think about the future? And what should we be doing now to get our political and economic institutions back in shape so that they can cope better with the next challenge? Well, I just happen to know a few futurists, and my favorite one is a very smart, funny, and perceptive gentleman named Jamais Cascio. He lives in California, where he does a lot of work with a nonprofit think tank called the Institute for the Future. So I called up Jamais to ask for a foresight thinker's take on the pandemic. So we've talked once before for this podcast back in the fall of 2016 when I was first launching Soonish.
Yep.
And in that interview, you introduced yourself as a professional futurist and an easily distracted generalist.
That sounds pretty accurate.
So how do you describe yourself these days?
Doomsayer, apocryphile. No, I'm still futurist, still easily distracted generalist, but I am not fun at parties is probably the best way to describe me at this point.
That's actually not true. I'm sure Jamais is a lot of fun at parties. But his point was that he's not focused on utopian futures. He's actually got a bit of a reputation as the dark futures futurist, the one who isn't afraid to dwell on all the things that can go wrong. Jamais told me that one of his recent presentations left so many of his audience members in tears that he decided to put some pictures of kittens into the next version to help people feel better. Anyway, when we connected on Zoom, Jamais shared this concept that he's been playing around with since even before the pandemic. It's called Banny. I'll let him explain what that means. But the more we talked about Banny, the more I felt like it really helped to clarify my own understanding of this crazy time we're living through. It gave me a lens for understanding how we got into this mess, where the US has less than 4% of the global population, but more than 30% of the world's COVID-19 cases, and why it feels like we're not getting any closer to a resolution of the crisis. And also what we would need to do to gain back some control over our future. So here's how today's show will work. I'm basically just going to play tape from two long conversations that I had with Jamais, where he explains the Banny idea, and we kind of grope together toward an understanding of what it can tell us about the pandemic and what the world might look like after this is all over. But before we learn more about Banny, we actually need to meet a direct ancestor of Banny named VUCA. Here's Jonathan Woodson. He was an Assistant Secretary of Defense under President Obama. And this tape is from a talk he gave in 2013 at the Harvard School of Public Health.
When I was spending time at the U.S. Army War College, where I got a degree in strategic studies and strategic leadership, one of the concepts I was introduced to and became fascinated by was the fact that strategic leaders had to operate in what we call the VUCA world. VUCA is an acronym for volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous. Now, you throw those words together and you say, what? Volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous. The concept at the War College was that strategic leaders and senior leaders had to feel comfortable operating in the VUCA world. War, by its very nature, is volatile. It's uncertain because every time you develop a battle plan, the enemy is going to change that battle plan after the first encounter. It's complex because you're talking about everything from arms to terrain to culture to political objectives, and it's ambiguous because many times these things are rapidly changing and you get the fog of war, if you will, and it's hard to sort things out.
Now, like a lot of catchy concepts, VUCA got picked up pretty fast by the business world, and it made its way into lots of presentations about management and strategy. Here's one deliciously overwrought example from a 2017 video made by the consulting firm Deloitte.
Volatility, uncertainty, complexity, ambiguity. This is the world we call VUCA. A world where non-stop unforeseen turbulence invades, where events come at us with unforgiving speed, straining organizational odds of survival. In this world, reflexes must be rapid and on target. Who will survive? Only the fittest. Who will triumph? Only the agile.
Even though VUCA evolved into a buzzword verging on a cliche, verging on a joke, Jamais says it did have its uses.
You know, here's a piece of language that has the inherent seriousness. It's from the army. It must mean something. And it's kind of fun to say. It's a VUCA environment. It became a very powerful way of articulating the broad sense of dislocation. Not that everything was completely upended, but everything was sort of tilting onto its side. It was a very useful way of identifying situations in which your standard operation behavior may not work properly.
In his futurism work, Jamais says he ran into the VUCA concept all the time. He even had clients who would ask him to build it into his presentations. But as he thought more about VUCA, he says he started to feel like the idea was so ubiquitous that it was losing its power.
Yeah, I jokingly said at one point, I eat VUCA for breakfast. It's that kind of feeling of everything around us is volatile, uncertain, complex, ambiguous. And that term doesn't have much utility if it's describing everything. So it's like that line from The Incredibles. If everyone is special, nobody is. Well, if every situation is special, if every situation is volatile and uncertain and complex and ambiguous, then nothing is. It's no longer a useful heuristic.
Okay, so I'm trying to think of another metaphor here, but let's think of a thermometer maybe. Like the VUCA was a thermometer that only could measure temperature up to like 212 degrees, right? Up to the boiling point.
Right.
And now we're boiling all the time, right? So VUCA isn't necessarily giving you much useful information anymore.
Right. And that's actually a really nice way of putting it because it may be we're in a situation where we've topped out. And so we don't know whether we're at, you know, instead of 212, are we at 214 or 250?
So Jamais started to think about how to make the idea useful again.
A few years back, I was really trying to dig down into the nature of global change, and just looking at what was happening, particularly with climate, but then across the spectrum, I realized that there is a step beyond VUCA that we need to identify, something beyond VUCA that will allow us to make sense of the world again. And after some time and conversation, what I came up with was, the acronym is BANI, B-A-N-I. Which has the delightful coincidence of being the Old Norse word for death, which felt very, very appropriate at the time. BANI, B-A-N-I, stands for brittle, anxious, nonlinear, and incomprehensible. And as you can see, each of those is kind of a step beyond, from volatile to brittle, from uncertain to anxious, from complex to nonlinear. From ambiguous to incomprehensible. And that felt right. And it felt like it was saying something about the world, allowing me to make sense of the world in a way that VUCA had lost its ability to do.
You're not necessarily arguing that VUCA is an invalid way of describing the world. It's just that the world itself has evolved beyond that. Bandy is sort of turning it up to 11 and bringing things back into the realm of describability.
It's very easy to assign nearly everything that's happening in our world, even pre-COVID, to one of these four categories of being volatile or ambiguous. Now this is a tool with Bani to step back and reevaluate. Is it just volatile, or is it actually a brittle situation that could shatter? You know, is it just uncertain, or is it anxiety-inducing in a way that could essentially lead to terror? Is it complex, or have we gone beyond complexity into pure chaos?
Now, VUCA and its younger cousin, Bani, are both just tools for thinking. There's nothing about them that's magical or God-given. But as I read what Jermet's been writing about Bani, and as I talked through the ideas with him, I did start to feel like it has a couple of strong selling points. One is that we're living through a time when it really does feel like history is going off the rails. Nothing seems to work the way it was designed to anymore, especially our political institutions. So, brittle, anxious, and incomprehensible are pretty good subjective descriptions for how things feel these days, at least to me. Bani's other selling point is that if you start to walk through it point by point, it does help to explain what's going on at this exact moment, when the coronavirus has brought the world to a near standstill.
A pandemic, certainly a pandemic at the scale and manifestation of COVID, is something that will push a VUCA world past that, into a Bani environment. One of the Bani characteristics that is in many ways the most visible is this brittleness concept, this idea that systems that appear strong, that in some ways may even be strong, shatter when they receive pressure, not just bend. We've seen this with our healthcare system. We've seen this with our ability to communicate and cooperate effectively between the federal and the state levels. We had systems that we had just assumed were working, that, you know, in some ways were working. But when they get hit by something outside of their context, when they get hit by something bigger than they would normally handle, instead of bending and adapting, what happens is they're shattering.
Maybe also our system of low wage and temporary service jobs.
Oh, God, yes. That's an excellent example. The labor structure, the class structure of the United States in particular, the jobs that are truly essential are the ones that get paid the least. The food's essential are the people who are going to drive around and do a DoorDash delivery. The people who are going to be stocking Costco at 6 in the morning. You know, the people who are doing their damnedest to make sure that they're not infecting us as they deliver the fundamental parts of our material existence. And it's not enough just to, you know, give them a nice round of applause and call them heroes.
Well, it's meaningless if you're not backing it up with job security
right.
And healthcare.
Exactly. In some ways, if this pandemic had started 6 months earlier, we would see Bernie Sanders as the Democratic candidate. Very likely, because this is the illustration of what happens in the United States when you don't have easy to access, cheap or free medical care. But yeah, brittleness. Whatever cover we had for it, whatever illusion had been cast upon it, has been ripped away. It's very clear just how fragile the structure of our society had become.
Right. Although it's not hard to apply the other parts of Bani to the situation as well, and just maybe to run through them quickly. So how does anxiety manifest in this situation?
Well, aside from the simple anxiety of, oh my God, the world's falling apart, I think of anxiety-inducing, you know, anxious, as being the feeling that emerges when there's no good answer. When choices have been made, decisions have been made without a visible, plausibly positive outcome. There are no good options. That's an anxiety-inducing system, when there are no visibly good options.
Nonlinearity is super clear because, for one thing, the pandemic spreads mathematically in an exponential way, right? It's out of control.
Right. One of the important elements of a chaotic environment, and you know, nonlinearity is part of this, is the sensitivity to initial conditions. I remember in James Glick's Chaos, that's a term that gets used repeatedly, sensitivity to initial conditions. And we can see this in many ways with the different nonlinear curves across the U.S. from different states. You know, California flattened the curve in a way that Ohio didn't quite manage to, and the way that Georgia is nowhere close to. They all have slightly different initial conditions, initial choices being made, leading to very different nonlinear curves.
Just for the sake of completeness, why don't we try incomprehensibility? So,
well, I think it's incomprehensibility in the connection with COVID has less to do with the manifestation of the virus and much more to do with the decisions made around the virus. Why did China suppress all information about the virus initially? Why has Trump been making the decisions that he's been making, suggesting possibly injecting ultraviolet light into a body, you know, let alone bleach or disinfectant? It makes no sense. It makes your brain hurt.
So you can see how Banny offers not just a good description of the pandemic itself, but also a way to get your head around all the weird and surprising side effects the pandemic has had for our economy and for our politics. But it's also important to understand that, in a way, this crisis we're living through wasn't a surprise at all. Part of the role of futurists and foresight thinkers like Jamais is to model various futures and to think about the big trends and forces that could shape history. And they've always seen global pandemics as one of those forces. The problem is, pandemics usually start when a microbe mutates or jumps from one species into another, and you can never tell exactly when that's going to happen, which makes a pandemic what futurists would call a wild card.
A wild card being a transformative event with a kind of global reach that leaves a system changed in a way where it can no longer function in the way it did before. What you have to remember with wild cards is not that they're simply big. They're global. They leave the world in a way where the new system can't go back to the old system.
In fact, here's a spooky story from Jamais that demonstrates just how long futurists have been worrying that nature would deal us this exact wild card.
Back in 2008, the Institute for the Future, where I do most of my work, put together a massively multiplayer foresight exercise called Superstruct. And I worked with Jane McGonigal, and Jane did the management of the game. I wrote the scenarios behind it. And one of the scenarios was called Pandemic. And it was an imagined disease called respiratory distress syndrome, or REDS. And we basically spent a few weeks going through with a collection of several hundred, maybe even over 1,000 participants from around the world, thinking about, okay, how do we respond to this future?
The Institute for the Future even made some cool fictional videos to enhance the Superstruct simulation. Here's one from the pandemic scenario.
Welcome to the Global Extinction Awareness System. You are watching Super Threat Number 1, Quarantine. In 2019, respiratory distress syndrome, or REDS, is here, and it's not going anywhere. Outbreaks are just something we live with. Hardest hit, tropical and subtropical cities.
Remember, that video is from 2008. So it's a little uncanny that the real SARS-CoV-2 virus turned up in the actual year 2019. And that, like the fictional disease REDS, it mainly causes respiratory distress. So the Superstruct exercise turned out to be frighteningly accurate. But that wasn't actually the goal. The designer of the game, Jane McGonigal, wrote on Medium this March that the most important work of such simulations is to, quote, prepare our minds to stretch our collective imagination so we are more flexible, adaptable, agile, and resilient when the unthinkable happens, unquote. In fact, a pandemic is completely thinkable. We can prepare for epidemics like SARS and MERS and Ebola and Zika. That's exactly why the National Security Council had a directorate for global health security and biodefense. That directorate's whole job was to work with other governments and NGOs to prevent, detect, and respond to infectious disease threats. At least until Donald Trump's White House shut down the directorate in 2018. And this is where Banny comes back in. Part of what Jamais and his fellow futurists have been trying to get across for years is that we know what to do to prepare for pandemics. For instance, the way to keep our healthcare system from growing so brittle that it's now on the verge of shattering would have been to build in more slack, to have extra hospital beds, and to stockpile more masks and ventilators before we needed them. But as a society, we've consistently chosen not to do those things. And we have leaders who have ascended to power on the strength of their argument that expertise is a form of elitism, that government is inherently ineffective, that planning somehow equals tyranny. I have this feeling that there's been a war against expertise going yes. on in this country yes. for a long time. It seems like the natural result of that is going to be an environment where even the most skillful futurists, even the people working their hardest to apply a VUCA mindset, are going to fail because the situation is just going to spin out of control. And then right. when it actually does, and a real crisis like the pandemic comes along, you wind up in Banny territory. But hey, that's exactly what they were working for, right? Because it's
right.
it proves that we can't prevent these things and that no one is really in charge. And moreover, it opens up space for deeply authoritarian responses.
So, yes, expertise is part of the resilience of a system. One of my favorite definitions of intelligence is how you know what to do when you don't know what to do. But if trust and expertise has been shattered, if the ability of expertise to produce signal above the noise has been broken, then we've lost that element of resilience. Furthermore, when you have a system where you give equal attention to truth and falsehood, a system where you give equal attention to long-term goals and immediate desires, you end up with a system where the bluntest, most obvious responses are the ones that get the most attention. Authoritarianism arises in these kinds of situations because it offers an understandable, a comprehensible solution to this kind of incomprehensible environment.
Once you're in a Banny situation, how can you see your way through it and out of it?
Mm-hmm.
We've already talked a little bit on email about how Banny situations can devolve into even worse situations, or sometimes if we're smart and wise about it, we can find ways to help them resolve into calmer situations. I know you've started to think through these different possibilities, so could you share some of your thinking?
Sure. We've already talked a bit about the importance of resilience, of slack, as a way of dealing with a brittle environment. So building up our capacity to absorb risk, whether that's through having a larger than officially necessary number of employees, whether it is having more intensive care beds than you need, that ability to absorb things that go beyond your day-to-day, that is pushing back against the brittle. When we think about anxiety, I think the shift from uncertainty to anxiety, one response that I think is useful is to actually engage in some level of mindfulness. And that's actually become really a really commonplace term of late, especially around people who are going through therapy or trying to figure out where they are in the world. This idea of trying to understand with clarity what's happening, to contextualize. Whether we can turn that into a broader social process, I'm not sure. I would hope so. I don't see it as impossible. But certainly developing a way of recognizing, accepting, contextualizing, and eventually adapting to big changes, that is a way of turning the uncertainty that's become anxiety into something that is salvageable. Trying to figure out how do you respond to an increasingly anxiety-inducing environment. You can't ignore it. You can't deny it. You have to accept it.
How do we respond to nonlinearity?
With nonlinearity, I've been thinking in terms of dimensionality. When you think linear or nonlinear, that's a two-dimensional concept. Is the line going straight? Is the line arcing up? Well, what happens if you step outside to the third dimension? What is the actual path being taken by that seemingly nonlinear pathway? Is it spiraling? Is it looping around? Is there some way of seeing it in a different way that makes it more understandable? What is the framework in which this is happening? So we look at the pandemic. Okay, well, what is this connecting to?
Yeah, like one of the reasons that an exponential growth curve is so frightening in a pandemic is because if you don't have a vaccine or even a treatment for it, you know that the medical system is going to crash.
Mm-hmm.
So part of the context here is we're not just thinking about how many new infections there are per day. We're also thinking about all these other dimensions, like how long will it take to develop antibody tests and ultimately a vaccine? Those are all parts of the context, right?
Right. No, that's actually a really useful way of putting it. You know, how do we put this in a larger environment, a larger context that gives it an added dimension that we don't really see if we're focusing solely on it? And so maybe dimensionality isn't the right term. Maybe I'm still groping around for how the right way of approaching it, but still it's the idea of moving away from the single line that you're focusing on, moving outside the line and seeing where it fits in a broader multidimensional world.
Right, right. Because even after the pandemic is over, we're still going to be stuck with climate change.
Right. And at the same time, our response to climate change will almost certainly be different than it would have been absent the pandemic. We will have seen a different world, whether it's a far cleaner environment, what that might look like, what it looks like to recognize an emergency. And so all of these become part of our language and how we respond to the dangers, the banniness of climate disruption.
And then as an antidote to incomprehensibility, you have suggested intuition or maybe even empathy.
Right. In an incomprehensible world, we don't have complete data. We don't have complete knowledge. So we need to construct meaning out of that. Well, what's the mechanism that allows us to construct meaning? The term that gets used to reflect that mechanism in our culture right now is intuition. You're stepping away from simply accumulating a list of presumed facts. And instead, you're looking at it, okay, well, how does this connect to other people? You know, what is the human response to this?
What would be a more intuitive or empathetic response to the pandemic than the one that we're seeing out of Washington?
Anything. I think a more intuitive or empathetic response to the pandemic than what we're seeing come out of Washington would be a response that is cognizant of what it would mean to a city, to a state, to a nation, to lose so many people. And to think about having 50,000 plus deaths as being more than just a number. We've now crossed that line now, we're counting up to 100,000. And think of it in terms of, okay, 50,000 deaths, 50,000 families damaged, 50,000 relationships broken or more. And what is the right approach to speak to that aspect of the pandemic and not simply how many boxes of N95 respirators do we have?
In the final part of our conversation, I asked Jamay to think with me about two possible paths forward. One, where conditions get even worse. And another, where we all start thinking a bit more like futurists. That is, where we decide to listen to what the pandemic is trying to teach us and do the hard work of rediscovering our own competence. What happens if banny situations get even more out of control? What happens then?
Things fall apart. The center does not hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. No. Okay.
Well, you've come up with another acronym, STEM, and it's not the one that we all know and love.
Oh, no. STEM, thus thinking shattered, terrified, exponential, and meaningless. So if you go from volatile to brittle to shattered. You go from uncertain to anxious to terrified. You go from complex to nonlinear, exponential, I'm a little fuzzy on that one, but let's go with it. You go from ambiguous to incomprehensible to meaningless.
Right. So we're talking about almost nihilistic, Kafka-esque territory.
Right. Right.
So, okay. We have these alternatives in front of us right now, and we are also in the middle of a national election season. And right. So... we have a lot of levers we could start pulling to try and bend the future in one direction or another.
Do we? And I'm not trying to be cynical, just a real question. What levers do we have at this point that we know, or at least have good reason to believe, will work? So I look at what's happening in DC, what's happening globally in terms of the rise of authoritarian populism. I look what's happening with climate, and I truly wonder what we can do, because we know what to do in many respects with, you know, climate in particular. We know what to do, but we, this broad civilizational we, don't seem to be willing to do it. We know what the solutions are, but in every case, whether we're talking politics or climate, or sort of go down the list, the pandemic, the people who have the most to lose by change tend to be the ones in power. And so it's very difficult to make that change happen.
You're absolutely right. There are so many cases where we know what to do, and yet we don't seem to be able to do it. My optimistic scenario is we muddle through on the strength of efforts like the regional governors' coalitions. We manage to resist the temptation to go back outside too soon. We figure out some way to have a metered and perhaps cyclical return to normality. We are more ready to go back into work from home and self-isolation on a dime if we need to. Biden gets elected in November. Trump doesn't try to stage a coup, and there's a mandate for some kind of New Deal scale reorganization of the social contract with government starting next year. That's like the super optimistic scenario. Does any of that sound realistic to you?
Yes. You started out by saying muddling through. If an optimistic scenario doesn't start with muddling through, then I know it's not real. Muddling through is, in almost every case, the best realistic option. And so muddling through and making the right choices, that is entirely possible. There will be problems along the way. It won't come out perfectly. You know, there'll be attempts to do things that seem to be the right choice but turn out not to be. There will be people who take advantage of the changes in the world for short-term benefit. But in many ways, what an optimistic scenario is a scenario in which we recognize the problems and grapple with them. For me, the clearest pathway out of a banny world is responsibility. Looking at the world realistically, seeing the scale of the problem, and making some effort.
Soonish is written and produced by me. Our opening theme music is by Graham Gordon Ramsey. All of the other music in this episode came from Title Card Music and Sound in Boston. You can follow us on Twitter at Soonish Podcast. At our website, soonishpodcast.org, you can find the show notes and a transcript for this episode, as well as a link to an essay by Jermay Cashier that goes deeper into the whole Banny framework. A special thank you to Jermay and to everyone who sent in a voice recording for our new audio montage at the top of the show. That list includes David Asaf, Jennifer Athey, Tamara Avishai, Ibi Caputo, Kip Clark, Matt Frassica, Charles Gustine, Lucia Prosperi, Warren Prosperi, Paolo Robusco, Julia Robusco-Stevens, Joel Roston, Paul and Patricia Rausch, Jamie Rausch, Kieran Athey Rausch, Lucy Athey Rausch, and Tarek Walton. To all of you, your renditions of our new motto were really fun to listen to, and I deeply appreciate your support. And if you, dear listener, feel like supporting Soonish with a per-episode donation, you can do that at patreon.com/soonish. Every dollar helps to keep this one-man independent podcast afloat. Speaking of independent podcasts, Soonish is a proud founding member of Hub & Spoke, a collective of smart, idea-driven podcasts. And I've got so much Hub & Spoke news to share. For one thing, we've brought one more show into the collective. It's called The Briny, and it's the creation of radio producer Matt Frassica, who tells stories about how we're changing the sea and how the sea changes us. It turns out that during the pandemic, there's been a big uptick in viewership for webcams at big aquariums like the Monterey Bay Aquarium. If you're wondering why people love to stare at jellyfish, you should definitely go to thebriny.net to find out.
They have the same music in the live cams that they have in the aquarium, which really helps it feel like you're there. It's this beautiful soundtrack by an artist named Douglas Morton.
Yeah. So how have you been finding yourself using those webcams to sort of cope with the pandemic stress?
When I am getting overwhelmed by Twitter, you know, just flipping on to some jellyfish for 2 minutes, not for a super long time, it has the same sort of effect that being there in person does, which it just slows you down.
Elsewhere at Hub and Spoke, Erica Heilman, the creator of Rumblestrip, has produced a truly poignant, heartbreaking, uplifting series of 7 episodes about life in this pandemic. The miniseries is titled Our Show, and it's built entirely from audio sent in by listeners. It's been getting national attention for good reason, and you can find all 7 episodes at Rumblestrip Vermont or at transom.org. I've got some other fun news as well. If you like Soonish, you'll probably like another podcast I've been producing for MIT Technology Review magazine. It's called Deep Tech, and it brings tech review feature articles to life in audio form. You can hear it at the magazine's website at technologyreview.com/podcasts/deep-tech. And finally, I have a new book out. It's from the MIT Press, and it's all about the search for extraterrestrial life and extraterrestrial intelligence. It's called, wait for it, Extraterrestrials. I'll be doing a whole Soonish episode about the book soon, but I'd be honored and grateful if you could buy the book and give it a read. You can find it on Amazon or at mitpress.edu, and I'll also put a link to the book in our show notes at soonishpodcast.org. That's it for this week. I'm Wade Rausch. Thanks for listening, and I'll be back with a new episode soonish.
Have the future we want, we can, but work for it we must.